Pelle Nyroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. Well, there's a Chinese curse that goes, may you live in interesting times. May you live in interesting times. That's a curse. And we are living in interesting times. And we've got two guests on our second hour to explore some of these things. We've got John Halsman, who's the author of The Last Best Hope, History of American Realism. Is Israel willing to use nuclear weapons against Iran? We're not out of the woods yet. And we're going to talk about that and other Middle Eastern issues. We've got Piers Robinson, a friend and a returning guest who is a British expert on media studies and co-edit director of the Organization for Propaganda Studies, and passed as a very senior academic at Manchester and Sheffield universities. We're going to talk geopolitics with both of them. But before we do that, I'm just going to give you an update on what's happening in Georgia, the country, not the state. The Parliament of Georgia has just passed a law on foreign agents in the second reading, 83 votes in favour to 23 against. Well, we don't know. As I said to Basil in the first hour, this is worries about the Israelis or the West, sorry, creating another conditions for another Maidan revolution. And we had a very pretty girl saying we've got to defeat the evil Kremlin-backed regime. But I don't think that this, the Dream Party, which is running Georgia at the moment, is pro-Kremlin. It's simply pro-survival of their country, wedged as they are between the West and Russia. And they don't want to be torn from both sides, as happened with Ukraine, in my view. And there's also, interestingly, the allegations. So this foreign agent law is trying to put a dampener on Western NGOs setting up shop in Ukraine, in Georgia, and creating the kind of impetus for a staged, managed coup using students and demonstrations outside the parliament. And in actual reality, this law is no different from the US law against foreign agents, Foreign Agent Registration Act. So I think it was a very wise move by the Georgians. This Dream Party is actually pro-NATO and pro-EU. I don't think they ever get to join NATO, but they're pro-EU. So, I mean, they're not Kremlin-backed by any means. And the hotheads who are calling for trouble are calling for trouble for their country. I think we've got an interesting sort of Ukrainian involvement here. There's a guy called Kit Klarenberg. I can recommend you go to his articles on Georgia, where he outlines how we know, going back to 2014, how the Ukrainians there was a sort of snipers standing in the Hotel Ukraine, which was owned by the so-called rebels, were firing at their own side, as well as the Berkut, who were the Ukrainian police, indiscriminately. And this has been well documented by one of the guests on my show, actually, called Kachanovsky. And I mean, he spent years, and you can see, it's so voluminous, it's hard to get your head around, but it's totally persuasive. I mean, the shortened version of what he's saying. But basically, even I think the BBC reported at a moment, when a brief moment of honesty, he was allowed to make a news night program about this, how Western journalists sitting in this Ukraine hotel saw snipers shooting at their own side, as it were, to cause trouble, basically, and give the impetus for toppling of the Yanukovych government. Yanukovych, again, wasn't a Kremlin stooge. He was simply trying to keep his country together and at peace. And he was ousted by an attack on the parliament after this shooting of both. It's a classic false flag incident. Well, apparently some of these snipers were Georgian and others were Lithuanian or Polish, and there's an American guy involved in it, although I don't think there's a wholesale American involvement. Well, are we going to see history repeating itself? Because some of these Ukrainian names who masterminded this whole thing are in Georgia at the moment and sort of fomenting trouble. So, I mean, many, many Georgians are very well aware of these things. And so if you want all the technical details and all the names and places, I recommend you go to Kit Klarenberg's Substack, or is the article where he's written that. The other development I really wanted to draw your attention to, just came up very late today, is Macron's interview with The Economist, which is a terrible magazine. I mean, it's completely up, it's totally compromised in terms of its connections to the British deep state. But he has a very sort of pompous looking Macron on the cover of that magazine, obviously bigged up by The Economist as the spokesman for a new hawkishness in Europe. And he said, if he asked whether he's going to send troops to Ukraine, he thought they knocked this on the head a month ago. He said, if Russia decides to go further, we will in any case have to ask ourselves this question of sending troops. And his refusal to rule out a move as a strategic wake-up call for my counterparts. Russia cannot be allowed to win in Ukraine. And his conditions are if Ukraine asks for it and if Russia makes a breakthrough. So those two conditions, well, I mean, Ukraine is already losing on all fronts. So Russia could already be said to have made its breakthrough. And so all it requires for France to send in troops that will trigger World War III is Ukraine's say-so, Ukraine's acquiescence. And of course, we know that the Ukrainians are a bit crazy, and they wanted to launch World War III when they were sent a missile into Poland the other year. So, you know, is peace hanging by a thread, or is this just more Macron grandstanding? We know that Premier Xi of China is coming to Europe this week, and his first port of call will be France, and China is very pro-peace. So is he just putting out there to make this guy walk tall, France and Macron having not been taken seriously for a very long time? Or is it a warning, another warning? Because you could say he might not be able to back down after he's made these repeated threats. And he doesn't seem to have been too impressed by the fact that when this was last mooted in February, March, all the major NATO states, Germany, Britain even, surprisingly, Italy, America, said, no way are we going to send in ground troops. He had some support from the Baltic states, but they didn't really count militarily, maybe some Poles. So are we going to have to go through this whole will he, won't he farrago again? We'll talk about this and other things with Basil, our political editor, after a very quick news, very quick break, very quick transition. This is the Pelliner of Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelliner's Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine, our political editor, with us again. What do you reckon on that Macron threat, Basil? Is it just more a French grandstanding, cock crowing?
Yeah, it's interesting that Xi is going to Europe for the first time in 5 years. And as you said, France is his first port of call. He's also going to Hungary and Serbia. Serbia, of course, traditionally allied with Russia. And Hungary, the most reluctant of all European Union countries to continue the war in Ukraine. So two very carefully selected capitals there. And one kind of thinking the same about France, that may be where in Central and Western Europe he gets the most sympathetic ear from a president with regards to the war, because China's help or diplomatic support for the Russians in the war is the main bone of contention at this visit. The European Union is threatening to hammer China's electric vehicle and green energy industries with tariffs because, of course, the huge subsidies they claim China gives to its manufacturers, which give them an unfair edge. So it's a testy visit. There's no doubt about that. But the spokesman for the Chinese foreign ministry, Lin Jian, has said, using typically diplomatic Chinese language, that Xi's visit will inject stability into the development of China-Europe relations and make new contributions to peace and stability in the world. Now, you can say, oh, well, that's the Chinese. They always talk like that. But for my money, it would be refreshing if some other world leaders talk like that as well about peace and stability.
Well, it's interesting that Scholz went to Beijing two weeks ago, was it, or something? And it was followed by a spate of articles about how the Chinese have been spying and a number of arrests, you know, one in Dresden, I think, and one in the UK and right. So on. So one way of reading that is it's a European deep state is fighting back against any peace with any friendship with China. But I just want to say one interesting thing. I thought that Xi is not going to London. I mean, in the old days, London and Paris were the natural diplomatic capitals of Europe because they were NATO members and had colonial history and, you know, diplomatic know-how and nous and whatever. And now he goes to Serbia, Hungary, which are sort of backwaters countries, but in a way they've carved a niche for themselves by being neutral. And it also shows how the diplomatic center of Europe is kind of shifting to the east, just as Dubai and Istanbul are places where diplomatic talks take place, you know, between Kiev and,
yes,
and Moscow. Serbia has a role, and London is like total backwater. Who goes to London?
Well, that's right. I mean, partly because of London's endlessly sort of round-headed, hard-line stances on just about everything. Interestingly, Chancellor Scholz is due to dine with Macron and Xi and their wives in Paris tonight. So a little round table there of two senior European presidents with Xi. And when they have a dinner like that, I believe it's a private dinner rather than a state dinner, that tends to indicate a sort of friendliness, or at least an attempt at friendliness, you know, rather than the sort of simply stiff formal negotiations either side of those flag and flower bedecked tables that we see at these international meetings, Belly.
Well, it's interesting. I wonder what they'll talk about.
You know.
Scholz and Macron don't have anything in common, you know, Xi. But it's hopeful in that sense. But it's interesting that obviously Scholz, they're so jealous. It's so, in a way, diplomacy is rather childish. No one wants to be left out. And so Scholz says, can I come and sit in? Or and Macron didn't want the Scholz love affair with China because of German exports there. And he wants to carve a role for France. So the two big powers are getting together, and including China. But Scholz is very anti-NATO escalation, and Xi is very anti-NATO escalation. So I can't believe that Macron said this unless he'd kind of cleared it with Scholz beforehand, don't you think? I mean, if he hadn't cleared it with Scholz beforehand, he's going to have a miserable time tonight at that dinner.
It's one way of putting it, Pelle. Yes, oh, to be a fly on the wall there. He's going on to Serbia and Hungary, apparently, to pull those two countries closer. They are large recipients of Chinese investment, including financial aid for the derailed rail project linking their two capitals. Did you know that? Budapest and Belgrade, due to be linked.
I did know that, and I don't know why I know that. I read a magazine called Hungarian Conservative, and that has that kind of news on there, because it's all part of this China Europe connection, you know, connection.
Yeah. To completely pivot away to a different topic altogether, the one that we were talking about on the previous hour, the United Nations Assistant Secretary General Abdallah al-Ardari, speaking at a press conference in the Jordanian capital Amman this afternoon, has said that the cost of reconstructing Gaza is likely to surpass $30 billion and could reach up to $40 billion, with an estimated 37 million tons of rubble to be cleared. And amongst that rubble, of course, an enormous amount of human remains. Now, that's assuming, of course, that the Israelis allow Gaza to be rebuilt as a Palestinian territory. Its future status is very much in doubt, and lots of greedy Israeli politicians have been eyeing up their condos on the beach there already. But it did strike me as well, Pelle, that $30 to $40 billion, obviously it's a lot of money, but there are several individuals in the world with three or four times that amount of money. You know, the likes of Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk. You know, it strikes me as a tremendous lack of imagination in a way. Somebody like Bezos could offer to rebuild Gaza entirely out of his own pocket as an act of unprecedented philanthropy. And what a message of hope and goodwill that would send to the world. He would still have $100 billion after he's completely rebuilt Gaza. But the people with all the money don't have much imagination, do they, Billy?
No. Well, just one thought I did think is that as soon as anyone with charity hands out money, if you've been on the Spanish Steps or wherever in Rome and hand out money to the beggars, 10 more come, right? So there are a lot of deserving issues in Africa, I guess. Maybe, you know, people living on 20 cents a day or something. But yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, absolutely. You know, the concentration of wealth in a few tiny hands is one of the biggest problems that the world faces. And it's one that's only got worse in the last 10 years, isn't it?
What struck me, the average African doesn't have enough wealth to own a plastic bucket, I read somewhere. Incredible, isn't it? That's you can hire out plastic buckets in parts of Africa at a profit because people don't have even enough for a plastic bucket.
To buy one.
Don't quote me on that. No. I have to look it up now.
No. But
that struck me as a horrific example of poverty that still exists in the world. Anyways, Basil, I'm going to go to my next guest. Have you got a show tonight that you want to flag up?
Yes, I'm covering for Patrick between 9 and 11 p.m. UK time, 10 p.m. and midnight Central European time, 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States. And I hope to be joined by, among others, Andrew Feinstein, former aide to Nelson Mandela, of course, who is due to stand against Keir Starmer in his St. Pancras and Holborn constituency in London at the next election on an anti-genocide ticket.
Right. Mandela was an MI6 asset. Anyway, thank you very much, Basil. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show on a Thursday afternoon, and we'll have Basil back tomorrow, and we've got our third guest coming up very quickly after a very quick break.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
It doesn't matter what you think about the Jewish people. If you don't agree with the IDF murdering women and children, then you are an anti-Semite, of course. This is an extremely dangerous game. Once upon a time, that word actually meant something quite powerful. Actually, it caused people to lose their jobs. It led to politicians losing elections. It led to people's lives being ruined, and sometimes even led to jail terms. Now, it leads to people saying, get lost. There is only a certain amount of times that you can accuse people of being something they're not, and in this situation, those times have definitely passed.
Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Facts and truth.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinero Taylor Show. On this Thursday afternoon, well, tonight, the Israel's war cabinet was meeting at 6:30 p.m. to discuss the next steps in negotiations to achieve a hostage deal. Now, the question is which way they'll go, and whichever way they'll go, they'll alienate a certain part of their domestic opinion. And it might, some people, analysts have speculated whether, Netanyahu might not go for either rejecting the hostage deal or accepting it, and might go for an option that favors his career personally, which is to escalate and seek a regional conflict, and that might keep him in power and out of jail if that's the possibility. Now, we thought that the Iran-Israel conflict has kind of quietened down a little bit after the Israeli counterstrike that turned out not to be, but we've got John Halsman to say that we're not out of the woods yet. John is the author of The Last Best Hope: History of American Realism. He's a managing and partner of John Halsman Enterprises, a prominent global political risk consulting firm. He's a senior economist for City AM, the newspaper of the City of London, and he's written To Dare More Boldly, The Audacious Story of Political Risk, published by Princeton University Press in April 2018. Welcome to the show, John. Welcome back, I should say.
It's great to be back.
Good. So you reckon Israel, we're not out of the woods in the Middle East. Can you tell us a little bit more why you think that's the case?
Well, just today, I mean, we've always said the canary in the coal mine is in the north, not the south, with Hezbollah. That from Iran's point of view, they don't particularly care about Hamas. I mean, they're Sunni, where the Iranians are Shia. This, they're expendable. They're a grant organization. They pay them. They cause damage. They report back. I've dealt with grant organizations my whole life in Washington. That's basically how they work. Hezbollah is a different animal. It's the crown jewel in the Iranian influence in the region, whereas Hamas has thousands of missiles, most of them very bad. Hezbollah, tens of thousands. Hezbollah has a plurality of the voting in Lebanon, controls the southern part of the country, is embedded in that country, and is Shia. So the Iranians care a lot about them. And Hezbollah and Israel have had a very low intensity conflict going on while everything else is going on. The Israelis have made it clear in statements. Mr. Halevi, General Halevi, who runs the Israeli Defense Forces, said just today that he's preparing for war in the north as well. And American analysts have said this is on the cards unless Hezbollah withdraw 30 miles from the border, which, by the way, they agreed to do many years ago under the UN and then, of course, haven't done. And the Israelis have been warning and warning and warning them. Nothing is happening. And so watch that northern front, because this has always been the area most likely to escalate. This is of several magnitudes of more importance than Hamas.
So what, how would it play out then? Would Israel try and create a sort of, what's the word, a attack, and to create a free zone where it can't be attacked from Lebanon? Would they make another incursion or what?
I think they go, the Litani River, which is what they agreed to go back behind, is about 30 miles from the border. And that is a buffer zone. That's exactly what they wanted and why they agreed to the ceasefire in the first place. And then Hezbollah immediately violated the agreement. And the Israelis at the time didn't have the juice politically to go and deal with that issue, having just fought a war with Hezbollah. In this case, they wanted to go back to where it was with the UN mandate. Notice nobody in the UN saying a word about Hezbollah violating this for the last 10 years, I might agree. You won't hear a word from Guterres or the other Wilsonian lackeys about this. But I think that would be the worry of the Israelis, to just push them back where they ought to have been and agreed to be in the first place. And it would make some of their missiles, the shorter range stuff, which is more accurate, it would make it much harder to hit northern Israel. And so I think it would start out limited. But as always with wars, as we've seen with Bismarck saying, when you draw the sword, you roll the dice. Things don't often turn as you plan them.
No, exactly. But some Israelis are talking to themselves and telling maybe their allies that we're only going to push north, push Hezbollah north to beyond the Litani River, which is some miles inside Lebanon, only to get them out of our short range missiles. And that's actually in accordance with the UN resolution, which Hezbollah have ignored for many years. That's the sell, right?
That is the sell, because you would flat foot the international community, which hates you. You would say, look, I'm following international law. We're just doing what was agreed at the UN. They've been in violation of this while you've been gutless appeasers for the last 10 years. It puts the onus on the very people attacking Israel. It's hard for the Biden administration, torn as it is, and we've seen this just today with the eviction of the camp, the pro-Hamas, not pro-Palestinian, it's pro-Hamas camp in Los Angeles. Let's call it what it is. The Greta Thunbergs who run that camp have been thrown out, but the Democrats are in a terrible state. If they pacify the left, which they need to win states like Wisconsin and Michigan, if they pacify the left, they lose all the independent voters who are pro-Israel. The last poll has Americans 4-1 in favor of Israel over Hamas in this war. But if they don't do anything, the kids are calling Biden Genocide Joe, and they're in his own party. So they're damned whatever they do. But if Netanyahu were to do this, it puts the onus on these Wilsonians to say, we're just following international law, which is what you guys are talking about all the time. So politically, that would be the sell and the very smart play. Yeah.
Well, the question is obviously what Iran is going to do in response to what Israel did. We'll talk about that after the news break. But if we can summarize what's happening in the south now, this Israeli war cabinet, what do you expect them to do with this ceasefire deal?
I mean, I think that they're going to kick the ball while they decide all these other issues. They're not just going to say a knee-jerk yes. They're going to look and respond and weigh up all these other strategic options. The Israelis are very good at this, and they've got to get their ducks in a row. As you rightly explained, Netanyahu's precarious situation. If he doesn't address the ceasefire, he loses Benny Gantz in the war cabinet, the most popular politician in the country. If, on the other hand, he goes along with Gantz in some sort of deal, he loses the far right, his coalition falls apart, and then he's got to worry about jail. So he is the Harry Houdini of Israeli politics. But the knots are very tight this time.
Very interesting. Okay, John, we're just going to go into a news summary, and we'll be back in a minute or two with Iran's possible response. Thanks a lot. This is the Pelinero Failure Show on TNT News Talk.
Here we go.
TNT Radio News.
News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. U.S. Representative Virginia Fox, supported by House Speaker Mike Johnson, announced that the Committee on Education in the Workforce, which she chairs, is investigating the response of university leaders to recent campus disruptions linked to the Israel-Hamas conflict. At the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, two student members of the Pi Kappa Phi fraternity intervened when pro-Palestine protesters replaced the U.S. flag with a Palestinian flag.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction,
misinformation from the truth.
From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelinero Failure Show. On this Thursday afternoon, we've got the excellent John Halsman, author of The Last Best Hope, History of American Realism, geopolitical analyst, who's talking to us about the Middle East and Israel and the difficult choices that are faced by Netanyahu, the Houdini of Israeli politics. So, John, if the Israelis do go after Hezbollah, what's Iran going to do?
I mean, this is the $64,000 question, because if it remained limited, this is a gigantic if, but if it remained limited, I think Iran would let that go. But if there's any sign of Israel continuing, or say Hezbollah crumbling in the face of this attack, and let's remember, the Israeli military are really very, very good at what they do. If there's any sign of that, or them losing this asset, they would almost have to be dragged in. This is, again, I wouldn't say World War III, this is more the sleepwalkers, Christopher Clark, the World War I scenario, where everyone doesn't want to get dragged in, but everyone has made interlocking alliances. And so to save face, has to go in. And if Hezbollah were being humiliated and Iran did nothing, all the years of growing that Shia crescent, which is dominating the Middle East, challenging Saudi Arabia and Israel, that would all go up in smoke. And there's no way the mullahs will let that happen. And so the danger is that they feel honor bound to go in to save their asset. And of course, if they escalate, then everybody looks to the next domino in the puzzle for this World War I type scenario, which would be the United States. If Israel is actively at war with Iran, face to face now, as we've seen happen with the missile shooting, but if they're face to face fighting with them, the pressure on the United States to do the most dangerous words in foreign policy, do something, becomes overwhelming. And so it's step by step by step we have to watch. The North has always been the area for escalation. As long as the war has been localized in the South, it's relatively manageable, at least regionally. But the minute you go north, you get these dominoes and this World War I effect much more in play.
Well, you're an exponent of geopolitical realism. What do you think America should do, could do, and is likely to do?
I think the United States doesn't need to directly intervene here, and I think for a variety of reasons it shouldn't. First of all, Israel, our ally, doesn't want us to, which helps in this sake. Unlike Ukraine, which would love it if the United States intervened, which would be the worst possible thing to do, the United States, the Israelis don't want us to. The United States would share intelligence with Israel, would help them diplomatically, would help them in terms of weapons and wherewithal. It's already doing those things. So I think that would continue, but on a much higher level. However, politically, for Joe Biden, this would be the nightmare scenario. He's already down in all seven of the battleground states, according to Real Clear Politics. And out of the margin of error in the southern ones, by the way, he's got to win the three Rust Belt states to win. That's Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Michigan particularly has a large Arab American community that's quite radicalized, quite politicized, and he needs the kids to come out and vote for him. And they're not. At the moment, he's only up over Trump by 8 points. Last time it was 27. So he's in peril of losing re-election if he were to support Israel. But if he doesn't support Israel, he would lose internally the entire pro-Israeli thrust of the Democratic Party, the old guard of the Democratic Party, and every moderate voter out there. Remember, Americans by 4-1 favor Israel in this war. So to sit there, twiddle your thumbs and say to Israel, stop doing this, that's disaster too. So Netanyahu is in an unwinnable situation, but so is Joe Biden if this thing escalates.
So what do you think, if you fly on the wall inside the Biden campaign, because they probably work these things out, what... I mean, both these guys are in real trouble, both Biden and Netanyahu. Are they able to construct? We're not thinking about the moral rights and wrongs about this whole issue for the moment. We're just thinking, if Biden and Netanyahu could get together, can they find a win-win situation that would benefit the two of them?
I think that they'd certainly try, because as you say, forget the moral thing. And ultimately, realism is about political survival. It's not changed since the Athenians. If you don't survive, you can't do good things. Everyone thinks that who's ever been in power since the Spartans, and that remains true today. And Bibi and Biden both think, and everyone does, and they're delusional. That's why we read Shakespeare in school. But everybody thinks they're indispensable. And Biden certainly thinks he's indispensable. That's why he's ruining his party. Bibi the same, that Likud couldn't survive without him. And so you would look for them to quietly say, Bibi would say, can I finish in the south, take Rafah, eradicate and control all the towns within Gaza itself? That would be have to be part of the deal I would sell to my far right, and then work out some sort of ceasefire where you say nothing, cause no trouble, don't give me any hassles at the UN, don't lecture me in public, and in return, I won't go north of the Litani, I give you my word. I mean, that seems to me, that's the very narrow wiggle room. But the problem is Bismarck, when you draw the sword, you roll the dice. The idea that you can control the world to pinprick precision just isn't the way the world works. If that were true, the Hohenzollerns would still be in power.
So you think that the attack on Rafah could escalate as well? That's I think the implication of what you just said.
I think, yeah, the problem with Rafah is from an Israeli point of view, this is nuts. I mean, these people attacked us, they had a pogrom against us, and you're not letting us finish off where all their senior leadership are undoubtedly hiding. Yahya Sinwar, the man who led the attack, is hiding somewhere in a tunnel in Rafah, and it would be like in World War II from an Israeli point of view, let's not take Berlin. There's civilian casualties all over Germany. Let's stop. From an Israeli point of view, that's nonsensical. On the other hand, from the American point of view, there are a million refugees sitting there. Biden is a Wilsonian. He's not a realist like I am. He cares about international opinion. He believes in the fiction of the international community. He cares about human rights over tactically who's right or wrong about the war. And so this makes him drift towards saying, please stop. And we're at a moment of real loggerheads between the two of them. But the key point, and you're right, is they don't have a lot of room to maneuver, either of them. Normally, they could maneuver, fight the next fight. Here, they really can't. And so they've got to thread the needle together, again, beyond the rights and wrongs, just to politically survive, because they're both on the ropes, no doubt about it.
Very interesting. And, well, just to finalize, we've got about a minute left. I'm in Europe, we're extremely worried about a Russia-America clash, World War III and all that. And Seymour Hersh said that it was a question of an Israeli counterstrike, or an Iranian counterstrike, the first counterstrike after the embassy attack. The Americans rang the Russians and said, hey, what are your Iranian guys doing? And then so there was actually a back channel going on there where the Americans and the Russians were speaking. And I'm very much encouraged that, because we had a back channel in the Cuba crisis, without which we would probably have a nuclear war, famously, because the Russians were armed to attack. You know, if the Americans had gone in there, as the Pentagon wanted, we would have had nukes in Washington. So Do you think, we talk about the Americans, we got 30 seconds left, but what would the Russians do vis-a-vis their client, Iran, if all this exploded? I mean, what is their stance?
There's a great chapter in The Last Best Hope about the Kennedy brothers and just what you say about the back channels. I think that they would both use them. Nobody wants this to get out of hand to that extent. If that were the basic rule since the Kennedys is superpowers do not directly confront each other and nuclear powers do not directly confront each other. Everything's worked since then. Everyone would then be on the phone privately using back channels as the Kennedys did. Now, would we be as adept as the Kennedys? I doubt it from Joe Biden.
Okay. John Hulsman, author of The Last Best Hope, History of American Realism. Great to have you on. Thank you very much. And we've got our final guest today, Palin Eros Taylor's show on TNT after a very quick break. Thanks, John.
Pleasure.
Great.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most.
Thank you!
Thank you!
To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state,
Helen Neuroth-Taylor
on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Palin Eros Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. Well, one of the stories that not so many people have paid attention to as ought to have done is the fact that, on the Wall Street Journal, which is a very sort of right-wing, you know, pro-establishment newspaper, it was revealed that the CIA had leaked that Putin had not killed Navalny. Now, I mean, the Putin-Navalny assassination was a big story a couple of weeks ago. News cycle moves so fast, but, you know, it just cemented this reputation of Putin as the ruthless, bloody killer. And of course, it's particularly pushed by the British press. And Mrs. Navalny was wheeled onto the stage at the Munich Security Conference as a successor of Alexei Navalny. Well, he wasn't assassinated by Putin, according to the CIA, so he probably wasn't. Well, I think, to me, that sounds like a sort of sobering up of some of the Western intelligence. Some of them are starting to tell the truth instead of pulling all these hoaxes all the time on the Western public. 2 years ago, I think it was now, you had this Bucha incident where the Russians were supposed to have killed dozens or hundreds of Ukrainian civilians in a brutal manner. And that helped push Western opinion against the idea of a negotiated peace, which Russia and Ukraine were just discussing. Well, of course, this is not the first in this series of psychological incidents. A few years ago, we had the Skripals. I won't go too much into detail about that. And we also had this series of chemical attacks in Syria. It's almost forgotten now, but I remember it very clearly. It was said to be a casus belli for the West. Assad uses chemicals, and we have to bomb this country. Well, it was all a hoax. And who better to talk about that than Piers Robinson, a friend and a returning guest, who is co-director of the Organization of Propaganda Studies, founder of the Working Group on Syria Propaganda in the Media. A friend, he's writes on propaganda, conflict, and is a chair professor in politics, society, and political journalism, the University of Sheffield in the past, and before that, he was at the University of Manchester. Welcome to the show, Piers.
Good to be with you.
Good. You followed this Duma incident. And it tells us a hell of a lot of the way that Western governments operate in international institutions and the way we're just surrounded by lies after lies. So although it's 6 years old now, it's still alive in my mind and it's worth retelling this story. What actually happened at Douma and how did the Western powers spin it?
Well, the chemical weapons issue in with regard to Syria, and just to clarify, I mean, my work is ongoing. I'm currently working with Jose Bastani, first Director General of the OPCW, Hans von Sponeck, former Assistant Secretary General to the UN, and also Professor Richard Falk, raising a set of issues which were brought up by whistleblowers from the OPCW about the corruption, and the OPCW is the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, regarding the corruption of those investigations into the alleged chemical attacks in Syria. And my work's ongoing, and we're continuing to push on this. And I just came off a phone conversation with Hans about our next steps. Now, what happened at Douma? Douma was the last in a long line of alleged chemical weapons attacks in Syria. And it became very well known, partly because America, France, and Britain bombed Syria in retaliation for it almost as soon as it had happened. But it became particularly famous, stroke infamous, because there's controversy over who had done it straight away. But when the OPCW final report came out, then emerged that there was significant dissent within the investigation team. And what transpired through a large volume of leaks and so on, and also testimony from OPCW inspectors, was that the investigation had been manipulated in order to point the finger at the Syrian government when the evidence didn't actually show that. And this has created years of controversy. There's been UN Security Council discussion about it. There's been discussion in the OPCW about it. Aaron Matei from the Grey Zone has covered the story extensively. And of course, I've been involved in really sort of, you know, writing academic papers, but also reports based upon what had occurred. So this was essentially a manipulated event in order to blame the Syrian government for the use of chemical weapons. And the evidence is very clear in this case that the official narrative is not correct, that this was an operation. And as far as we can tell from all the evidence that we have at our disposal now, it was effectively set up by groups such as the White Helmets, who are connected to the UK authorities, British government. And it was an event which did also involve the murder of civilians, which is one of the issues that Hans and I continue to push, that we have 43 civilians who died in unexplained circumstances, and, you know, there needs to be justice for them. But what this is part of, and this actually links into your discussion about Navalny and also what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, this fits into a much broader, what I would describe as a propaganda narrative, which has been pushed by the West for many years to try to attribute essentially the use of prohibited weapons by, obviously in Douma, the case of the Syrian government, but of course, because it was seen as allied to Russia, linking in Russia with that. But obviously with the Navalny poisoning and also the Skripal affair in the UK, the Novichok story, this is all part of a broad-scale propaganda drive to delegitimate Russia and to present it as a user of prohibited chemical weapons, biological weapons, etc. And in this, and you noted this connection with international organizations, the OPCW, of course, has played a role in the Navalny initial poisoning before he had died, also played a role in Skripal as well. And what we found in the Douma investigation was effectively an overlap between some personnel and UK government, some might say just intelligence services, involved in helping to shape the outcome of investigations and so on. So this is where the way in which, you know, Western propaganda has caught in its contrails that the OPCW, and this OPCW is a UN-linked organization, and it really shows you how far these institutions are corrupted in the interests of essentially Western power. But it's a big story, but it's a story, and it's about, you know, building this narrative of the big bad ogre, Russia, chemical weapons user. And of course, this argument is being put forward about Ukraine. Hamish de Bretton Gordon is out there promoting the idea that Ukraine is, Russia is using prohibited weapons in the Ukraine. This is Iraq WMD 2.0.
Exactly, yeah. I was interesting, Basil Valentine, the political editor on TNT, he was at school at Tunbridge with Hamish de Bretton Gordon. He says he was the thickest guy in the school. It's impossible that he writes the articles that are attributed to him. Anyway.
Well, Hamish did accidentally let out at a Wilton Park conference that he is with a Times journalist, Lloyd, at an alleged chemical weapons site in 2013, I think. And he wasn't really supposed to let that out, because what that let out was, because that was actually an MI6 operation that was going on there for sample gathering, right, covertly, et cetera. So he right, let the cat out the bag on that, although I think they've removed recording. I do have a recording of it myself. So so he has let one or two things slip. I wouldn't cast aspersions on his intellect, but what I would say in the case of Syria is that he's played multiple roles. He's been a PR agent, as it were, for the narrative of chemical weapons use. He's also been involved in these covert sampling operations, and, you know, effectively fitting in with this broader kind of influence upon the OPCW and the FFM investigation. So he's playing multiple roles there, which is interesting.
I'll just give a summary of the story as I see it. And that's the sort of average guy who reads the alternative media kind of view, which is that it was the accusations that sarin was used, right? That sarin and was a really, really poisonous chemical substance. And what we saw on TikTok or on Twitter or whatever was these Syrians covered in dust and running around and choking. And then sort of the counter pushback came was that, well, these people were choking because there was dust falling from an explosion, and some of these people were interviewed by the Western media saying, well, there was no sarin involved, because sarin is really toxic, right? It was but what we did have when we were just coughing and choking was these people called the White Helmets, are actually MI6 assets, but who pretend to be, you know, first responders, coming in and filming us coughing and choking, and then putting that out on Twitter saying, look, they've been attacked by sarin. And then posting these pictures that obviously staged, when you think about it, when we're sort of chemical bomblets or sort of lying on beds or lying through open roofs and thinking, well, this is what the Assad did, but they were obviously placed there. And then we had the initial OPCW report saying, well, this is really terrible, Assad did this. And then I think what you said in your very long article, which I think you can read on your Substack, is OPCW whistleblowers said, well, this is all completely fake, you know. And then you had some pushback also from independent journalists like Robert Fisk. So they say, well, this isn't what you think it was. Can you just correct me and take over from there, from some of those basics?
Well, this is the basics of what happened in Douma. And there are other big alleged chemical weapons events, such as Ghouta 2013, Han Shikun, and so on, but we don't have time to go into those. But at Douma, what emerged out of Douma was that 43 civilians were filmed dead in an apartment block. Right. And then there were hospital scenes which were associated with that. And of course, BBC producer Riam Dalati famously has declared that the hospital scenes were faked, were staged. So that the scene, the impression you created of the White Helmets creating panic and shouting chemical, etc., and right, people panicking, etc., and then hosing them down with water. And so that's fairly well established, that the hospital scenes were staged. But then what happened in the apartment where 43 civilians were filmed, essentially the key problem that emerged from during the OPCW investigation was that they couldn't understand why 43 civilians would drop dead pretty much on the spot in this building, and with foaming at the mouth as well. Okay, is that this is not what you'd expect to see with chlorine. People would escape and so on. And NATO toxicologists who were consulted by the OPCW inspectors were very clear that these people were not killed by chlorine. No sarin was ever found. There's no traces of sarin, so that was ruled out. So, well, they weren't killed by chlorine. They would not have dropped dead on the spot, foaming at the mouth. And so what you then have emerging from that is you got 43 dead civilians, No explanation for how they died, foaming at the mouth, and so on. Bodies were moved throughout the course of the night. If you go through some of the database of imagery, you see, for example, a young boy being moved the next day, and he has rigid white material sticking out of his mouth, and so on. So this essentially looks so people who most probably murdered, but possibly killed in other circumstances, were then taken there and their bodies were piled into the building, which was the response of the NATO toxicologists who were advising the OPCW. And what happened to that critical assessment was that it was buried by the OPCW. And it was buried a second time when the investigation identification team report came out in 2023. And essentially they fudged the issue. And this is what they're left with. They're left with, how did these 43 people die? And this, the kind of circumstances of this was that, you know, this is an area that was being retaken by Syrian forces. Jaish al-Islam, extremist group who had been occupying the area, held a very large number of civilian prisoners underground. Not only a small number were ever released alive, so Islam, and then you have this event and 43 dead civilians. You have what, in my opinion, and I think the evidence points in this direction very clearly, a very serious war crime. And more importantly, it's a war crime that happened under the noses of the White Helmets and essentially British assets such as the late James LeMessurier, who was working with the OPCW to arrange witnesses, to supply information and so on. But this looks like a massacre. And
to summarize what you just said, because I missed something. Basically, these Islamists who we now know, the Islamists have always been allied with the MI6 to cause trouble in Syria. They were killing the people, 43 civilians, to make it look as if they'd been killed in a gas attack from the Syrian government, which would then give an excuse for us to missile them and attack them. And the British were involved in it because it happened under their noses.
Effectively a false flag type operation. My opinion, based upon all of the evidence I've seen, is that at least some of these people were most probably murdered. It is an outside possibility that these were people who just happened to have been killed somewhere else under other circumstances, and their bodies were repurposed, which is what Riyam Dalati has sort of suggested and conceded in a meeting with one of my colleagues. But I think the reality is that number of women and children, etc. And there's many other pieces of evidence which we know from the OPCW investigations, which were suppressed, which point to a very high level of manipulation. But they were probably murdered. Their bodies were taken away and buried by Jaish al-Islam / White Helmets. It's not quite clear who, in a mass grave with other people who have been killed as part of the fighting. So it's not rocket science, and you don't have to be, you don't have to be a police investigator to see that there's a very big problem here with what really happened. And there should be, and as Hans and I have been calling for, there should be a proper war crimes investigation of what happened and to get to the bottom of it.
We'll talk about the links to what we can read on your Substack for more detail. But is there any sort of simple way of forensic open shut case for the fact that they were murdered rather than gathered from and having died from other issues, causes?
Well, one of the observations by the original team who had their report suppressed was that there were strange markings on the face and around the eyes, and also their hair was wet as well. And they tried to get a forensic pathologist to come in and investigate, and that was blocked by a senior person in the OPCW. So if you could bring to bear a forensic scientist to come in and to look at the odd, inexplicable markings, then you might start to get further down the road of being able to say, this is what happened to these people. What we certainly know scientifically is that the scene that one is presented with, 43 dead civilians foaming at the mouth, that cannot be explained as a result of chlorine. That would not have happened, and it explains in detail in the Substack paper exactly why that is. There is a way you bring in the forensic pathologist. But of course, this is what they initially, the team, tried to do, and they were blocked from doing that.
So more than 40 people were possibly murdered to create the case for a Western intervention in the war in Syria. And it was all under the noses or some kind of complicity with the British or the MI6, who are organizing this whole propaganda campaign under the white helmets. And their boss, we've got 30 seconds left, James Missouri or whatever, however you pronounce his surname, he fell out of an Istanbul hotel room or something. So who did it?
Yeah, came off the roof of his apartment building 2 weeks after an OPCW official gave testimony to a panel in Brussels, the Courage Foundation panel. And he came off the roof in circumstances which some people think are unclear and suspicious.
Hmm. Okay. Well,
a lot there. I'm sorry, but
yeah, I know. No, it's okay. So it's fine. Piers Robinson, your Substack, I guess, has more details about this. I'm thinking about our poor audience who are really interested in. But Piers Robinson, British academic researcher and a brilliant scientist of politics and propaganda. Thank you very much. Love to have you on again. This is the Pelle Nero Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back tomorrow.